You are listening to Fika with Vicky on United Public Radio, 107.7 and 105.3 from New Orleans.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Fika. Our guest today is author Brad Smith. Brad has written 14 novels so far, including The Return of Kid Cooper, which won a Spur Award, Red Means Run, which was among Booklist's best crime novels for 2012, and both One Eye Jacks and Copperhead Road, which was shortlisted for the Dashiell Hammett Award. But most importantly, me was enamored of both Copperhead Road and The Goliath Run, which we'll be focusing on today. When it comes to experiences, Brad's been there, done that, and moved on to doing more. To give you an idea of what I'm talking about, he worked in the signal department of the Canadian National Railway and then moved on to a railway project in Africa. He's also been a bartender, truck driver, farmer, teacher, carpenter, and I can't remember everything else. But yes, when it comes to writing, you know Brad has a lot to draw from, leaving us with layered characters and stories that come from the heart. Because you can tell that Brad loves writing, even though he admits it's hard work. So thank you for working hard to create such memorable reading moments, Brad, and welcome to Fika.
Well, thanks very much. Thanks for having me, Vicky.
We always start with this. I'm sorry if it's monotonous, audience, but it has to be done. Can you tell us a little bit about those two novels so that people have an idea of what we're speaking about?
Okay. Chronologically, I'll start with Goliath. It came out first. The Goliath Run is a contemporary piece. It takes place in the U.S. and it begins with a school shooting, which is typical down there, a terrible, horrible event. And that's sort of the catalyst for what happens. One of the protagonists is a woman named Jo, and her goddaughter was actually killed in the shooting. And she is, of course, beyond grief. There's a guy who's on the radio. He's a media type, kind of a Fox News type of guy, who tells a lot of things on his show that aren't true. And he ends up attacking the parents of the kids for the kids being killed. And our protagonist, Joe, becomes so outraged by what he's saying every day. Very similar to a certain person in the States who was going around telling people that the shooting at Sandy Hook never even happened, you know. She became so outraged by this that she did not know where to turn, and eventually she came up with a solution, and she kidnapped the radio host's own daughter to teach him a lesson. So it's kind of a combination, a procedural, where they're trying to track her down with the kidnapped child, and he's fighting against her but still pushing his lies on the radio. And I don't want to tell you too much, but I don't want to get any spoilers involved. But that's the juxtaposition of the two characters anyway.
It is considered a crime novel. There is investigation in that as work, as well as the background story.
Yeah, the investigation is probably 50-50 with the background story and the character stuff. And it's there's some FBI agents and also local police that are trying to track her down. And she's a very, very smart woman, and she stays one jump ahead of them all the way through. Copperhead Road, we got to go back about 90 years. It takes place during the Great Depression in Appalachia. And it's about a place, the Flagg family, who have been manufacturing molasses down there since before the Civil War. And it takes place in 1936. And like everything else in the 1930s, there was no business happening. There was no market for molasses because nobody had any money to buy anything. And the daughter of the Flagg family comes home. She loses her job in Chicago. And when she realizes that the family's not making any money anymore, she stumbles upon this old guy who's making moonshine in his backyard and finds out what you can get for a gallon of moonshine. So she has this eureka idea that they're going to start manufacturing moonshine in the old molasses plant. They hire this fella, he's a black man from the backwoods, to teach them how to make it, but they have no idea how to ship it and market it. And when they try to, the bad guys end up pulling their trucks over and beating up the drivers and taking the moonshine away from them. So she ends up finding a guy named Bobby Barlow, who's a local. He's a bit of a ne'er-do-well to a certain extent. He's been in and out of jail a couple times, but he's a complete car guy. And all he cares about is racing cars. And this is in the fledgling days of stock car racing, when they would basically race in a farmer's field on a Saturday night. You might win $5 for winning. So she decides that he's the guy she needs to build her a fast car and transport her moonshine to the various markets around. So it's kind of about the relationship between the two of them, and also of the two of them staying ahead of the cops, known as the Revenuers back then, and the local crime family that's also a very bad group of people that they have to stay ahead of too.
So it has that Bonnie and Clyde vibe. And I love it. I love reading about that era. I loved Goliath's Run, but if I were to go to a bookstore and look at a book, I would just look at the cover of that book and bring it home. And it did not disappoint. Copperhead Road is, and I want to go on to read your other novels, but I'm definitely just reading that made me a fan right off the bat. And
thank you very much.
Goliath Run is just, well, these sound like two very different books, different eras, different times, locations, and yet they feel the same to me because they're both about people when the outside world, outside actions change their actions, how they would normally live. I'm sure that Eva's family was very God-fearing. You know, they would never think to break the law before the Depression and people were going hungry in their neighborhood. And Joe was pushed to things that she would never normally have done if her goddaughter had not been killed. So you are the man behind these words. Do you feel that there was growth that came from these things happening all the way around. They did things that they normally wouldn't do, and it changed them and the lives around them. Do you think that that rules weren't always there not to be broken, and that justice, our idea of justice, the book idea of justice, is kind of murky sometimes, depending on the circumstances?
Yeah, I definitely think it's murky, and the line that I love that I stole, it's on the front of the front page of Copperhead Road, is from Bob Dylan: "To live outside the law, you must be honest." And I think that's, you know, I'm not advocating that, kidnapping or breaking moonshine, but it goes back even to the days of Robin Hood. You know, Robin Hood is a perfect example.
I was I kept saying Robin Hood, go ahead.
Yeah. So we don't know how much of the Robin Hood myth is true. Maybe he didn't steal from the rich and give to the poor. Maybe he put it in his pocket. But we love the idea of him stealing from the rich. And in that case, it wasn't just the rich. He was stealing from the evil, who were making people more downtrodden than they already were. So there's something very romantic and very satisfying about that image, about somebody giving them their comeuppance. And if they have to break the law a little bit or bend the law a little bit for the good, then I think that's okay. And it makes for... it can make for a good story, you know.
It does. Now, first of all, Robin Hood did steal from the rich and give to the poor. He is a personal hero. I've done several shows where people with Robin Hood backgrounds have walked in. So, but yes, all the time I was reading, I'm like, do I dare say this is like Robin Hood? Will he get upset if I say Robin Hood? But then you said it, Brad, and it's perfect. So there are Eva, Joe. These are very strong women. Not in, you know, sometimes you see strong women in the armor straight from a video game. with superpowers and that's strength, but we're talking strength of conviction, strength to do what they had to do for the people around them, just intelligent, as you said, Joe, like they really think about what they're doing. Are you compelled to write strong women? Like, is there a reason you chose to do that? Or are there models? Like,
I've always wondered, you see it a lot in film, even nowadays, maybe a little bit less, but it seemed like so often you go to see a movie and the woman, the actress is just a placeholder. She's a wife or a girlfriend or a mother or something like that. And she doesn't really have any job. And the guys are driving the bus, right? And that's not true throughout history. It's not true right now. And it's not true throughout history either. When if you just look back and take any random list of women, like Eleanor Roosevelt, or in Canada, Susanna Moody, or Harriet Tubman, who's got a connection to our area here. I mean, this has been going on forever. And it's always puzzled me why they haven't really gotten a bigger stage, you know, a bigger spotlight. Because, and I think that there, when they're independent and super smart and very savvy, like Ava and Joe are, they're just much, much more interesting. And that they can make the counterpart more interesting too. But in Copperhead Road, for instance, Ava's counterpart is Bobby, who's a savant-like guy when it comes to cars, but he's not as smart as Ava. I mean, and he knows he's not as smart as Ava, which is pretty cool.
Well, Ava has some things going for her. She left the area for a while, so bringing back new things always helps. And at that time, she grew up in, her father was a minister, and, you know, there was a lot more reading and stuff going on in those households, I think, with the Bible and stuff. So she would have a leg up there. But speaking of Bobby, poor dear Bobby, we look at him and we say that. We say that Bobby ain't so smart. But that Bobby could rip apart a car and put it back together like nobody's business. And who else knows what else he would have done if given the opportunity? So, you know, we often as a society look at people because of their accent or their country of origin, or, you know, even the poverty, which, you know, Bobby had a lot going against him in those ways, and judge them as not being as intelligent, or, you know, that class system. Happens. Was this you making comment upon that? Because the same kind of thing happens in there's that same kind of idea in Goliath's Run, with that class system and we're better and whatever.
Well, Bobby, I think it's a compliment to say that somebody is very simple. You know, it sounds like an insult.
No, I get you.
Yeah, and Bobby is a very simple guy. His whole life, for instance, he went and served during World War I. And when he came back, he had, you know, that to deal with. But his whole life has been very kind of straight ahead. And he's not complicated in any way, really. And he's had his problems. Like I say, he's been in and out of jail a couple of times. But he's not, you know, some sort of a mastermind of anything. He's just living his life, and he's a very simple guy in the best way. And maybe meeting Ava brings out a little more in him about not so much of what's right and wrong, but about he's kind of pushed into an area where he may have not entered on by himself, you know, like after, I don't want to tell too much, but after
Ava, I know it's hard.
Yeah, after Ava bails him out of jail the first time and he kind of sees what's going on, he changes a little bit, but he doesn't change a lot. You know, his morals are the same, and his tunnel vision is kind of the same. He's more excited about building them a fast car than he is about the moral aspect of selling moonshine, because building fast cars is what he loves to do.
So it could be that it's not just Ava, but he has a goal. Like he has a goal and a possibility of reaching that goal because the finances are being. So he is Lynyrd Skynyrd's simple man.
There you go. Yeah.
They wrote the song.
That's the first time somebody's come up with that. Very good.
I love that song. So it happens. Okay. We have a question from author Brian Greiner. Perhaps a better description of Bobby might be uncomplicated rather than simple. Well, we've already, I should have got that question before. We're going with simple, Brian. But I hear what you're saying. This is the problem with language and how it, there are so many words that society, that are lovely words, but society has given them a negative type of meaning, right? Like, yes, but we are now very positive about Bobby being simple. I'll do that.
Or uncomplicated.
Or uncomplicated. It's okay. Brian and I have disagreements all the time.
Well, tell Brian he can offer any advice. Any suggestions are welcome.
excuse me. Allergies again. But there's definitely that class system thing happening in both of these books. Do you look into that often with the other books? I haven't had a chance to read them all yet.
Yeah, I think there's probably a common theme. Like even in Goliath Run, the cop, the New York cop, Bell, he's being looked down upon by the FBI. Mm-hmm. So there's that too, which is kind of a sub story, but it's very much there, and they don't consider him to be a real cop because they're FBI, right? And as it turns out, again, we don't want to say too much, he outsmarts all the FBI agents.
Well, yes. Yeah. I sometimes think we need to do a show and then make everybody read the books and then do a second show where we can actually get into the characters and things, because this drives me crazy. So Copperhead Road, it's a historical crime fiction. You've gone to another place, another time. How much time did you put into researching for that?
Unfortunately, I would jump in the car and go there. Like I wrote a book that took place in Gettysburg, and I would jump in the car and go there. It's like a 6-hour drive. This was right in the middle of COVID. So I couldn't get across the border, but the wonders of Google and all kinds of books. There's a great book. I should have it here for you right now. It's called Driving with the Devil. That really dealt in great depths about the early stock car drive races and stuff down there. And that was the other thing that really made me get into this book to begin with, is because I always knew that some of the early stock car drivers, like I said, that were driving around a farmer's field in their dad's pickup truck or whatever, they were guys who used to run moonshine who became stock car drivers. But until I started researching that, I didn't realize that worked both ways. The moonshine runners were going to the racetracks and saying, okay, that guy there, he's the best driver here. They would recruit him to come and work for them. And back then, of course, everybody was so broke. If you could make an extra $2 on a Saturday night running moonshine, or $5 or whatever, you would do it. So this is, and of course, the whole stock car thing became the juggernaut known as NASCAR today, which is a multi-billion-dollar thing. But this is really back in the really raw roots of the sport, you know, where if you had a $50 car, you could be a stock car driver. Nowadays, you need $1 million car.
Well, I remember. No, I was going to say, when it comes to car prices, like even when I was young, I think my father picked my first car up for like $50 at a Wreckers and say he did it. So things have come from those prices really fast.
Yeah, when I was a kid, when we were 14, we started driving when we were like 14, not on the road, but my buddy had about a 30-acre farm outside of little village Canfield. And we bought several cars, and I don't think we ever paid more than $30. We bought one for $10 and one for $20. And we had our own track in the field, and we would just run those cars hard. But by the time we turned 16, we kind of knew how to drive, you know.
So this was a natural for you to write this book, and yeah, with that as the basis, as well as you own your own 1936 Ford Coupe.
Yeah, mine's actually a 37.
Oh, is it a 37? Okay.
Yeah, they're very similar to the untutored eye. You wouldn't know the difference. Yeah, so my car is basically very much like the car that Bobby builds in the book. Yeah. And my dad used to race cars too. He used to race at the drag strip near here. And when I was a little kid, he had a 37 Ford Coupe.
Now, would you race this car, or is it too much of a baby? Like,
it's not a baby, but I don't race it. No, I've got a couple cars. I've got a 68 Mustang too, which is, if you know the movie Bullet with Steve McQueen.
Mm-hmm.
The Mustang, this is one of the most famous car chases ever. I have a pretty similar car to that, except mine's not green. My coupe has got old paint on it. It was last painted 60 years ago or something. But I rebuilt a flathead engine like I used in Copperhead Road. And I spruced it up a bit. I put two carbs on it and dual exhaust and stuff like that. But it's a pleasure car for just driving around. It's not a race car.
And no. So you were, and that was Driving with the Devil. It's about the history of NASCAR and those things.
Yeah, it's a terrific book. Yeah. Like some of those guys down there were just unbelievable. There was one guy named Roy Hall, and there's a song by Jim Croce called Rapid Roy, that stock car boy. Look it up later. And he was wanted by the law most of his life, but he was still racing on the weekends. And a couple of times he dressed up as a woman and raced so the cops wouldn't recognize him.
They would all be quite notorious in their areas of, you know, can you imagine if that was going on now with all the news and that, you know, when so-and-so is off and people would be cheering for them or the, or the cops.
And getting back to your earlier comment, when I stumbled across that, I thought it was really interesting that they allowed women to race back in the 30s, because I just thought that it was all men.
You know, I think that there was a big difference, like growing up, out in the rural area here. We didn't actually have a farm, but I would go to the friends of a farm that had farms and mm-hmm. watch their mums. And they did everything, grow the garden, and people did not mess with them, okay? They had their own power. And yeah. I sometimes think that in rural areas, the women had to do more, anyways, the point was, in rural areas, they sort of have their own ruling. And if it needs to get done, it gets done regardless of who.
And probably if you dug into it deep enough, there were a lot of cases when the women did a lot more than the men, depending on the man himself. You know what I mean?
Oh, hallelujah, bro. Hallelujah. Yeah. No, but they did a lot. It's something that people... you have to sort of live that to really see it happening, the power that was theirs, because their jobs were just as important as that time. They weren't considered.
And they found, like, I was the same as you. I grew up in a little village of 100 and some people, but surrounded by farms, and most of my friends lived on farms. So I would go overnight on the farm, stuff like that. And you're right, their mothers could, I mean, they just weren't making the oatmeal in the morning and doing the ironing. They were out in the barn doing the chores, and if there was wiring problems or electrical problems, plumbing or whatever, they could chip in and do it all, you know, because you didn't phone up a plumber or electrician in those days, you know.
Do it yourself was a religion, okay? You weren't going to give somebody else money to do something that you were capable of doing yourself. That philosophy still causes me...
Yeah, well, like, people ask me about what I know about cars and stuff, and like I say, I've got some old cars, and I always said, when I grew up, if the starter went out of my car and I took it to the garage to have it replaced, my dad would have disowned me.
Okay, we were supposed to be talking about the book, but I just have to say, when I was older and I started working, I went and bought a newer car. It wasn't brand new. It was, but it was a newer car. I spent more than anybody because I was tired of seeing my dad under the car in the cold winter. He was getting older, fixing the car, right? Like, I just wanted something where they didn't say, it's okay, just take it easy when I pulled it out of the driveway. Anyways. Oh my goodness. I created the havoc that I created by just buying this car and paying this money was, you gotta live it. So when I read these books, when I read that, it's almost like, even though that was way before, but not as far as I'd like it to be, but it really feels like home. You know what I mean? It's not like we were moonshining out back, but there's something about it that just pulls you in, a familiarity that is, I don't know, almost instinctive.
I like the little authentic moments. You and I talked a little bit about Steinbeck when we were off the air. In Cannery Row, do you remember when Mac, I know you remember this because you're a Steinbeck fan, when Mac and the boys go to get the frogs?
Oh, yes. Yeah.
And they borrow the Model T truck and they back it up the hill. Well, they have to back it up the hill because the transmission bands are so worn that they won't go up and forward gear. But that's such a nice little thing. And you can tell that John Steinbeck knows exactly what it was like to drive a Model T Ford.
Yes, those little details are important in writing. And I think that's why I was drawn to him. That feeling of the rural, the gritty, the making it work. Okay, so Brian's back with, all your books seem quite serious in tone. Do you ever, as a writer, feel the urge to try something else, such as a light comedy or other genres?
I don't know what books Brian has read, so I can't comment too much on this, but I've been told that my books all have a fair amount of humor in them. Goliath, maybe not as much because when you start with a school shooting, you can't get too light. But Kid Cooper, Red Means Run, Busted Flush. I was nominated for the Arthur Ellis Award. I think my books do have a fair amount of humor.
They cover life. So just in life, there's humor as well as the dark side. I'm thinking Copperhead Road its humor was just about life, right? Like things that happen that you can't. It was pretty serious.
Well, the baseball stuff was.
Yeah.
was meant to be funny. You know?
No, that was. It's just a mixture. But I know I haven't read it yet. But in reading the synopsis for Hats Off, which you wrote the screen, was made into a movie.
All hat,
right. Yeah. Because they're all hat and no cows, right?
All hat and no cattle. Yeah.
yes. So that is supposed to be a lighthearted movie with its funny moments. And so therefore I feel that the book is. Yeah. We have to read more, Brian. We have to read more. Dave asks, I should read.
I know a little bit about this. There's a place not too far from me, about 10 miles up the lake. There's a place called Austin's Park. And the owner of Austin's Park, believe it or not, his name was Park Austin. And his daughter is a good friend of mine, and his grandkids are good friends of mine. And he had stories about rescuing some moonshiners off of Lake Erie at once. And there's been a couple of good books written about the guys that ran Booze Across Lake Ontario. There was a guy from Hamilton named Ben Kerr, and I think the book was called Whiskey and Ice. And it's a very interesting book if you can find a copy of it. Ben Kerr ended up owning the Hamilton Tigers, which were an NHL team at the time. Tigers, not not football. And they actually played out here in Dunville against the Dunville Mudcats, who are kind of a iconic team. If you're from this area, you've probably heard of the Mudcats.
Yes, yes.
Yeah, so I don't know a lot about it, Dave, but I have heard quite a bit about it because, as you know, Prohibition was lifted earlier in Canada than it was in the U.S., which opened up.
Big business. And Hamilton had quite a crime scene for a while. I'm just going to read the question for those because on the radio or whatever who can't see the question. Dave was just asking Brad if he ever thought about writing a book about the moonshiners running across Lake Erie in boats, not in cars. So that's what we were talking about. Oh, he corrected himself. Robin. Good morning, Vicky and Brad. He's out west. Was wondering, Brad, what inspired you to write about mysteries, crime, and such?
Yeah, that's an interesting question because I really didn't sit down to be a crime writer, and I don't know what really identifies a crime writer. I feel like I write character pieces, character studies, and I guess I was drawn into that aspect of things because it might be more interesting to write about a bank robber than a guy who, you know, delivers mail for a living. So I think One Eye Jacks was an early book, and it was about a boxer who was just trying to get some money to buy his family farm back or to save his family farm from the creditors. So it didn't really start out to be a crime novel per se, but I guess it kind of morphed into a crime novel because of the people he ran into trying to raise the money. And the same, I guess Copperhead Road, basically, because of the moonshine thing, was going to be a crime novel all along. But it was more like I'm just interested in character studies. And I heard Elmore Leonard talk one time. I had a chance to talk to Elmore Leonard once on the phone, but I heard him in a separate interview, and they asked him what he had to start a novel. And he said the only thing he knew when he started a new book was what the protagonist did for a living. And I thought that was pretty interesting and hard to believe, to tell you the truth, but he had no reason to make that up. So yeah, he would start writing a book when all he knew was what his protagonist did.
Which brings us to, your books are fast paced. They, you know, the character's there, the action's there, it goes until it ends. So I can see you just sitting down and start typing. That's how I picture you writing. But is that how you write, or do you plot a lot before getting in there?
No, I've never done. And I always say, I always preface this by saying there's no right way or wrong way to.
Oh, write no, all. No. We have writers of all, but it's always interesting.
I would say you can write one page a day for 300 days if you want. I wouldn't recommend it, but I've heard of people who have Bristol boards on the wall, you know, laying out where everything was going. And usually when I start a book, I know the beginning and the middle and the end, but I don't know all the details. And sometimes I don't know a lot of the details, but I've never really wanted to do a really intricate outline because I feel like it would take away from the spontaneity of things. Every book I've ever written, there's been a character who has surprised me to a certain extent. So it's not accurate to say that they write themselves because that's kind of bull, but they kind of reveal themselves to you, you know? And so if I had a very specific outline, I might lose that. I might just say, okay, this guy here is only going to be this or whatever. So I've never wanted to, and it's worked okay for me so far. Just knowing the beginning and the middle and the end type thing. And then once you start writing, it kind of fills itself in, you know. And of course, when you start rewriting, that's when it really gets better too, you know.
So you've said that it's hard work. I mean, it's one of the hardest jobs you've ever done. It's about sitting there every day and doing it. That's where the discipline comes in. Not just having the dream, but sitting there and doing that work. How did you gain the discipline to do that? Do you have any suggestions for other people out there?
It's a difficult thing because it's absolutely the toughest thing. And with me, it was at some point, I told myself that I had to prove that I could do this. And so it was like a challenge. So I couldn't allow myself to fail. And once I published the first book, it I was going to say it got easier. It didn't necessarily get easier, because working is, Dorothy Parker said, I hate writing, but I love having written. I don't feel that strongly to say I hate writing, but I know exactly what she's talking about. I love having written. So once you kind of get into the groove and tell yourself, okay, this is what I have to do. And with me, I make myself do X amount every day, because if I let it slip and let it slip, then it wouldn't happen. But again, I mean, that's different for everybody, you know. Like some people start writing it if they're, maybe they might have kids at home, they start writing at 10 or 11 at night, you know, and I could never do that. I don't think I was writing in the morning.
You find it best to do it always at a certain point. Like, that's a part of your schedule. I'm sitting down and I'm doing this now.
Yeah. And when people, sometimes they hear me say this in an interview, and they envision me writing 365 days a year. Well, that's not true. You know, when I'm working on a first draft, I'm working for, usually it takes me 3 or 4 months or whatever. And then usually I set it aside and then I go back into it, or I might show it to a person or maybe a couple of people. But yeah, I'm not writing 365, and I'm not sweating over a computer every day for hours on end, you know?
Well, you just ruined that image.
Sorry.
Oh, I know, but no. So you write for some time, take some time off, go about your life, and then.
Or I have another project on the go. I do some screenwriting and stuff, so I might move on to a different project or whatever. And
so that's still ongoing. It wasn't just something that you did and you're moving on. You're still enjoying screenwriting and you're still working at it.
Yeah, I recently finished a rewrite about a baseball movie, actually, and I can't say too much about it, but it's finished now and it's kind of making the rounds. So it's not one of my books. It's not an adaptation, but I've adapted a couple of my books, and a couple of them have been under option right now. Red Means Run is under option right now to a Canadian company. So yeah, there's always, I'm sort of on the periphery of screenwriting, but movies nowadays, they seem to have, to some extent, passed me by a little bit. I'm kind of in love with the movies of the 1970s, for instance, with the golden age of movie making, with, you know, The Godfather and Cuckoo's Nest and so many great movies. And nowadays, there's so much stuff is post-apocalyptic, which is fine if you're into that, or it's Marvel comics, or it's horror. And it's just a lot of really big budget, like crazy budget stuff.
But indies are making a pull with the way the world is, and with computers and that, it's opening up, and there's a lot more indies going out there. And I think with that, we'll see more of that, you know, that kind of thing.
But they're harder to make too, you know.
Getting the producers and getting the money is difficult to do. Yeah. But there is hope. There's always hope.
I agree. I hope you're right.
Okay. Nancy would like to know. Hello, Nancy. What are you working on now? I want to know that too.
I have two projects right now. Well, three counting the movie thing. But I have a book that's done. It's not coming out until next year. And it's for Brian, it is lighter. It's almost a political satire, and it takes place in Ontario. I haven't set a book in Ontario for a while, and it's about a small city similar to Hamilton, and it's mostly about the Greenbelt situation here, and it's very fluid because of the Greenbelt situation, which has been kind of a movable feast for the last few months, as you know. And it's about a guy, a baseball player. This is kind of my baseball novel. I've never really written a baseball novel, but I'm a huge baseball fan. It's about a guy who's a baseball player who's kind of forced into running for office in order to keep his job, because the owner of the team wants to split the vote in order to get his guy in. So that's coming out next year. It's called Billy Crawford's Greatest Run. That book's done. And getting back to moonshine for some reason. I was doing some research about the city of Moose Jaw. And I don't know how much you know about Moose Jaw, but they used to call it Little Chicago. And now I know why. Because it was a crazy place in the 1920s. And the population was only like 25,000 people. But it was brothels, speakeasies, gambling dens, all along a place called River Street, which is the oldest part of the city. And there was rumors that Al Capone used to travel there to buy booze and to hide out and stuff like that. So I've sort of, and this has got a more of a lighthearted thing too, I've sort of created a book around that. And it's not about moonshine like Copperhead Road is. It's more about the characters and revolving around us. And it's just such a, it's a really fascinating, it's a fascinating town when you think about where it was and when it was, you know, in the middle of the Canadian prairies, you know, you didn't expect to find that.
No, no. And it's interesting. I mean, that's what it is. You learn about something and then you think, what if, what yeah. if this happened yeah. or that happened? That's no, I went through your list of jobs. I have to say, it's pretty impressive for a writer to have. I mean, you have tons of experience. You were out there doing that. I wonder how much Steinbeck had to do with that, that lifestyle.
Or maybe it's just I couldn't hold down a job.
No, but I'm not saying that. Why are you being... why are you no I can see that as I pointed out at one point in time I too put a typewriter in my trunk and was going and was having a very good time till my husband came along. No, I love you guy. I had a friend stand in the driveway saying I blame Steinbeck for this. So I can see that, but okay, so then there's the question. Was it just that you couldn't keep down a job and you had to keep moving on? Or did you, I mean, you wanted to write forever. So did you have that thought that this would all, to live an eclectic life, to get those experiences?
No, I didn't. I wasn't that calculated. It maybe subconsciously a little bit, but it really wasn't that calculated. I really liked to travel when I was young. I'm more of a homebody now, but I ended up in Texas and Alberta and Africa and wherever. And wherever I went, because I had so many jobs, because I would go somewhere and I need money. So it was only so if I could get a job as a roofer or a bartender or whatever, I would do that. I mean, and it served me well because it got to the point where I could do a lot of things. And you're right, it definitely served me well in terms of when I did start to write, but it was probably more than the job experiences with the different people that you meet, you know, because mm-hmm. you meet people from all walks of life, you know. And that's, to me, that's probably the bigger thing than the jobs themselves, you know.
Well, in your bio, you wrote about listening to the neighbors in those days, people talked across the fence or whatever, listening to the neighbors, listening to their stories, these older guys that had been in Vimy Ridge or whatever. And in both of the books that I have read, there is this older gentleman, guider, if you will, that just sort of stays off the sides and gives, you know, opinions without having to be listened to or whatever. Do you think listening to the stories of older folks, seeing them as people and a life before you knew them, had any influence on those characters?
Yes. Oh, absolutely. I've always, when I worked as a carpenter, whenever we worked for somebody who was of my dad's generation, for instance, I would always quiz them, ask them, you know, how long have you been in Canada? Where did your family come from? And, you know, whether they came from Ireland during the potato famine or Italy, whenever. And it's always been fascinating to me, just in general, not. And the same thing, it's not calculated where I'm thinking I'm going to use this.
No. It's like listening to a radio story.
Exactly. And I'm always interested in people's lives, where they come from, because especially nowadays when there's people talk about immigrants a lot, you know, we're all immigrants here. And that really defines people, to not always, but a lot of times it defines them. If you think about the Donnelly family, you know, I'm sure you know about the Black Donnellys. That whole story, you know, it's about people shooting each other because they had rival stage lines. But when you dig into that story goes back to Ireland for mm-hmm. generations, you know, and the Orange Men and the Blackfeet and all that. So, you know, there's always that backstory that you need to get into to find out what's going on now. You know,
I always say you can't. One of the reasons I'm doing this show is to hear people's stories, because you can't understand a person unless you understand their stories, the stories of where they came from, the stories that were there. And this goes many, many generations. Like, I still believe there's a lot of families suffering troubles from World War One, World War Two. You know, people go without a dad, whatever. It just continues down, right?
Yeah. Oh, for sure. Yeah. Yeah. It's like, you know, walk a mile. Remember the song "Walk a Mile in His Shoes"? Yeah, that's very much what you're talking about. And you can't figure out the present unless you know about the past.
And it's not for blaming. It's for cause and effect. This happened, yeah. And that hurt. I mean, sometimes I think we look back for different reasons. But if you looked back and thought, "Oh, those guys were crazy driving around those mountains," like. You don't get it because you weren't there. Okay.
Yeah.
I want to clarify, they were crazy driving around those mountains like that, but they had reason.
Yeah.
They had reason, and they didn't like being told what to do. Okay. This was an important aspect.
Yeah,
I'm Irish, so I'm allowed to say this. There was a lot of Irish people there, and okay, I got myself in trouble. But, you know, there's a tendency not to like to be told what to do, because they had been. They came from a country where they were.
Yeah. Well, the other thing about Copperhead Road is it was also work. There was no work.
Right, right.
So if someone offered you a job hauling moonshine to the next hauler, that was a job.
And that goes back to that whole... Even Bobby being in jail a lot because you did what you could to make money. I mean, bank robberies, that was the heyday of bank robberies and things as well, right? Because people needed to eat.
Yeah. And there were a lot of bank robbers in the 1930s.
Yeah.
Yeah, like a lot. And they were, a lot of them were portrayed to be Robin Hoods, but most of them weren't.
Yeah. Not what I've seen with Bonnie and Clyde. But, you know, something starts out noble and then it just attracts the wrong kind of people.
Yeah.
It definitely does that. Okay, so you mentioned, so I'm not spoiling this, Luther was a man of color, and he was basically running the show, making the moonshine, made the dozen and running. And you can see how in that need, everybody's roles became important. People became the boss of their area. Other people bent over to their expertise, like, yes, sir, I'm going to go do what you say right now. And all of those lines start to disappear and merge together because people have a goal and they're working.
Yes, it's very democratic.
Yes, and, yes.
Yeah, and there's really very little mention of Luther's race in the book. You know, there's a couple of derogatory terms from people that you would expect it from, but the rest of the time when he's involved with the Flagg family and they're making moonshine, everybody's an equal. And that shouldn't be a revelatory thing. But it's in the 1930s, it was.
It was a bit, once again, taking the time into context. I think that's so important. We go over, like you said, you lived a Huckleberry Finn life growing up. And yet some people will look at that book and say, well, this is a horrible book. And yet, no, Mark Twain was speaking against that. You know, the things that were happening. He was just in a time where he had to do it in a satirical manner. He was far above his time. And so people have to remember, you have to take it in the context that it was at that time. Not saying that that is the best way to be, but that is what they knew and was.
You're preaching to the choir here, because it drives me crazy when people, all of a sudden, that Mark Twain is kind of out of favor. Mark Twain was shining a light on this stuff. And now he's being criticized for shining a light on it, you know? I mean, he was totally doing the right thing, in my opinion. But now all of a sudden, it's kind of like they don't want to teach To Kill a Mockingbird. in school anymore because of some of the language in there. But Harper Lee was doing the same thing. She was shining the light on
Rachel. That was, and so there are books that are not read-alouds. I call them not read-aloud books. Yeah. But you definitely learn a lot by going there with them. But I have found someone, I think I'm going to see if they will come on the show about Mark Twain, because it's gone too far.
Hemingway called Huckleberry Finn the greatest American novel ever written.
Mm-hmm. And he wasn't even nice for him to give a compliment.
Yeah, especially complimenting another writer.
What was that quote? Never show me your work. I'll either hate you because you have no talent, or despise you because you're better than me, or something like that.
Probably the only reason he was complimentary towards Mark Twain is because they weren't contemporaries. If they were contemporaries, he probably wouldn't have said it.
Yeah, no, definitely. So I am totally off track here. So we talk about Steinbeck. How do you think he has affected your writing? Your life? What do you think that means to you? Because I mean, you've said that you read Grapes of Wrath every couple of years. He's definitely had an impact. What would you say that would be?
I think just because we had such similar backgrounds, and that he was so, actually, to get back to Hemingway again, even though he and Hemingway are very different, Hemingway said, when you write something, you can tell how much a person knows about something by what they leave out, as opposed to what they put in. And that Steinbeck's writing was like that. When he was writing, like taking the Red Pony or Mice and Men, when he was writing about those little farms back then, you could tell that he lived that. I mean, you could tell what it was like in that bunkhouse. You could practically smell that bunkhouse, you know. The one guy was putting liniment on his legs, and there was a dog, the smell and all that. And without overwriting it, he completely lets you know that he knew exactly what he was talking about. And he had so many different ways to do that. You look at Grapes of Wrath, how he went, especially early on, the first chapter would be about the people, and in the second chapter, there's a great scene in there where a turtle climbs up an escarpment or an embankment beside a road, and he gets a seed under him, and the truck hits the turtle, and he rolls over, and then the seed lands in the dirt somewhere, and it's going to sprout. Well, that's the whole second chapter, I think, about two pages. And then he goes back to the Joad family, the next chapter. But he does it so well. And it's just like, it's like a painting, basically, you know?
No, I can see Hemingway saying that, because regardless of what I say, I do, he was one of my favorite authors as well. I had a big thing for that whole group. And the conciseness of writing, which I see in your writing as well. Sometimes I like flowery, but in general, I will go for just to the point. This is, I think cutting is important.
Yeah. I think that's one of the reasons that nowadays I like Hemingway's short stories better than his novels. And he only wrote, five novels. And I still think his first novel, I don't count Torrance of Spring, The Sun Also Rises, I think is his strongest book. But when you get back into his short stories, especially some of those really short stories that are like two pages long, they're brilliant, you know? And I really think they're his strongest work.
Yeah, no, I can see where you're coming from.
Where Steinbeck, I mean, The Red Pony and A Mice and Men in Cannery Row are very tortilla flat, or very short books. But his masterpiece, The Grapes of Wrath, is a very long book, but he did both equally as well, you know?
Well, we don't give short stories enough credit. I'm really getting into them more so now. We just think short stories, but as, you know, I've learned from talking to different authors, and that they can be more complicated because you have to do it all in such a few words. Yeah.
And keep in mind that one of the best short story writers in the world is a Canadian.
Okay, Monroe. I'm going to take a chance. Alice Munro? Yes! You can see her. I did a show with a friend on Alice Munro because, and once again, it takes me back to that rural dirt roads kind of life that I can just read her books and live them. I can see it all. I can find them.
And she's very sneaky because you start out reading something and you go, well, this is very mundane and there's not much going on here. And by the end of that story, you say to yourself, I know people exactly like that. Like exactly like that, you know? And that happens to me so much when I'm reading her stuff.
Yes. No. And so I try to read a short story each my reading pile, but I try to for myself read that short story every day as Bradbury suggested, because you get the whole story there. You're not, it just stays with you all day. And it sort of centers your mind and balances it to other worlds than, yelling and carrying on as people like to do. I could just, this is the point. What do you said that, I know what we need to do. We need to find out where we can get your books, where we can, I have your website running across the bottom here, but for people who can't see, basically search Brad Smith's books on any engine and his website will come out up where at most at all of the.
Yeah, I think the typical, I always say, you know, support the indies as much as you can. There seems to be fewer and fewer indies. But if you have a good independent bookstore near you, if they don't have my books, they can definitely get them. And that's true about Indigos and Chapters and every place. And in the U.S., the same. I can't name any independent bookstores in the U.S. because I'm living in Canada. But, you know, Barnes & Noble and whomever, where you're going to find them, yeah.
Have you been in any of the local libraries?
Yeah. I've done a few events, actually, over the years. I did a one book haul event in Dunville last fall, but I haven't done one recently. Well, because of COVID, basically, I guess everything.
Yeah, everything got slowed down, and it's starting. And then we got old and just wanted to stay home, but it just happened during COVID. It's amazing.
That's what happened.
But people can also suggest to their libraries to get books in.
I think
you should be suggested. I'm going to go check it out. I didn't check out our local one, but yes, you can get him pretty much anywhere you can get books.
Yeah, pretty much. When your book comes out, it's going to be more prominently displayed. But after a year or two, it gets shuttled. You know, because there are so many books out there nowadays. There's more books being written than ever, you know, because of, you know, independent publishing and stuff like that. So you might have to look a bit after a year or two to find them. But yeah, most of them are available. My three Virgil Caine books are available. So.
And yeah, so you may have to go against Brad's sensitivities and order them.
That's fine. Yeah.
I don't think he'll mind if it's his books you're ordering.
Yeah. I'm not going to complain.
And so when, I know there's no exact date and it has to go through lots of different things and stuff, but any idea when you'll be done? Well, both books, but the Moose Jaw book, that one's going to be finished first, isn't it?
No.
No?
The political book is finished and it's coming out next fall. It's with Woolsack and Wynn out of Hamilton.
Yeah. Okay.
Which is a great press. This will be my first book I've done with them, Woolsack and Wynn. Yeah. And the Moose Jaw book I hope to finish sometime this year. I'm just working on the first draft now. I'm just kind of getting into it. I'm about I'm close to halfway through a first draft.
So okay, well, I am looking forward to those. And this is the point. The interviewer is not supposed to talk very much, but I want to talk to Brad a lot.
And the other place about getting the books is the two that we talked about today, Copperhead Road. and Goliath Run are available from At Bay Press, which is in Winnipeg, and you can Google them. But they have them open bookstores anyway. But it's At Bay Press.
And they look like they have a lot of good a lineup of books. There's a few in them.
They're an ambitious young publishing house. Yeah.
So okay, so this is our time up, Brad. I would love to read some more books and have you back to talk about them if you enjoyed your time.
Absolutely.
You have a great reading taste. So
what if I made that up and I really didn't like Steinbeck at all?
No, because you said it first. See, I read the book and I thought, oh, this guy, because there's a feel, right? Like there's a feel in this a Steinbeck book and Alice Munro or whatever. But I thought Robin Hood, and I thought Steinbeck. But I don't bring it up because I think I'm crazy most of the time. And then I look at your press stuff and it's like, you know, he says he'll always be a Steinbeck fan. And I'm like, okay, so there we go. And it's not, you know, people have to understand that's not a copying thing. That's not a, it's a way of writing, a method of writing that pulls in certain types of readers, right?
Yeah.
To be able to have, I always say people ask, how do I sell in different countries? How do I sell? And I said, I always say it does not matter. What matters is the experience, because that rural dirt road experience always pulls me in because that's the first thing I remember in life, right?
Yeah.
You're and correct. You do it well. Okay.
Thank you very much.
So you take care and we'll talk again. And thank you so much for joining us today.
Well, thank you, Ricky. It's been a pleasure.
Okay. Take care. Bye-bye.
Take care. Bye-bye.
And for the rest of you, I will see you all next week. Until then, may your coffee be hot and your story sweet. Thank you for listening, everyone.